Hello, I'm Patricia Camilleri. Welcome to The Artifact. This is the penultimate in this series, during which I've been talking to some of Malta's key archaeologists about archaeology in general and about the many projects that are in progress and are planned for the future. My guest today is Nathaniel Kutayar. Mr. Kutayar is the acting superintendent of cultural heritage. He gained his first degree in archaeology and history from this university and then went on to read his master's at University of York in archaeological heritage management. He worked first as curator at the National Museum of Archaeology and after the setting up of the superintendents, moved on to work there as curator of archaeology. He's been responsible for several excavations of the museum and of the superintendents over the last 10 years, and his special area of interest is archaeology of the Middle Ages and also, of course, heritage management. And he has published in this area, both locally and abroad. Welcome, Nathaniel. We go back a long way. We were students together. So I call you Nathaniel, if you don't mind.
By all means.
Today we're going to talk about medieval archaeology, specifically in Malta, and then later on, hopefully putting it in a regional context. This is not one of the most studied areas of Maltese archaeology, and perhaps underrated and sometimes even misunderstood. So I hope that during the programme you'll be clarifying a few issues for us. Perhaps you could start off by giving us a sort of snapshot of the state of research in medieval archaeology in Malta today.
Yes. If we consider medieval archaeology in Malta, one is immediately struck that how understudied it was before the 1990s, more or less. There were important episodes of research before that. Temizan meets excavations at Mdina at the Roman villa uncovered the Islamic cemetery of the 12th to 11th century. There was Halm el-Liri. These were important episodes which did not constitute a single fabric of research the way and the same way as happened for prehistory or for the classical world, where research was ongoing, so studies could link up and create a unified picture very early on. In the case of medieval culture in Malta, of course, history had primacy because medieval archaeology was studied ever since. I mean, medieval history has been studied ever since Abela. There's a long string of important contributions in that area down to our very own day. Medieval archaeology has been overshadowed by historical research, which has produced much more. This has changed in the course of the 1990s for a variety of reasons. First of all, across the Mediterranean, across Europe, medieval archaeology has become a well-recognized discipline in its own right, with its own methodologies and publications and fora for discussion and research. It was only a matter of time that Malta would have to come in line with international developments. Secondly, there has been a change in the philosophy and the methodology by which archaeology is practiced in Malta. At the very late 80s, early 90s, the state organization, the Museum of Archaeology, changed its approach to fieldwork, introducing systematic stratigraphic excavation as the norm rather than the exception, and adopting a policy which is one could loosely call one of rescue archaeology, intensive rescue archaeology. This has brought archaeologists into contact with situations which before were not being noted, especially in places such as Mdina and Cittadella, etc. Therefore, the data has started flowing in, and flowing in very fast, concurrently with the rate of development, in fact. And so today we have a much, much bigger body of stratigraphic sequences of material cultural groups. We are seeing the first publications, which are specific analytical publications on medieval archaeology. So we now have the benefit of about 15 years of work for all aspects of medieval archaeology, and all, not only on medieval archaeology, but the way it relates to earlier periods and later periods. So the research is... state of research is much better than it was, say, 20 years ago. The knowledge base is much bigger, and we can now speak with colleagues from Europe and North Africa and compare notes on a par. Of course, much work has to be done. This is just the beginning, and that is the intention of the superintendents, to push research in these key areas.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about research, I think probably a lot of historical research has gone into the Knights period, which clearly is a major feature for Malta. But the period prior to the arrival of the Knights, though, I think does have, if we're talking about archival information, we do actually have quite a rich basis on which to work if we want to use not archaeological excavation but paper research, archival research.
Yes, well, that was the point I was making earlier. Yes. There's the archival research is very intensive. Mm-hmm. It has many generations now of work to its credit. It is still evolving and flourishing. And has given us a very, very important set of documentations and insights into the Middle Ages. Mm-hmm. Of course, that can become a conditioning factor for the archaeological research, which is following in historical terms of time. Mm. And of course, the language of archaeology is different from the language of history. They run parallel and touch and very closely to each other, but they are distinct because archaeology deals with material culture and with landscapes, and archives deal with history deals with archival documentation, which is more about organizations and about the individual and its role in society. Mm-hmm. So the focus is different. The theme is the same. And what we're seeing is that aspects untouched, completely untouched by the paperwork, which would lead you to think that certain aspects of culture did not exist in Malta, are now emerging through the archaeology. So it's important for the medieval archaeologists to work initially in autonomy from history, almost, and then link up as a process of synthesis at a second stage or at a later analytical stage.
So let's talk a little bit about then the archaeological side. Quite a bit of attention has been given in the press and media over the last few years to the archaeological activity going on in Mdina, which many people have found very, very exciting. Have they brought up significant results for the Middle Ages?
Yes, Mdina has drawn a lot of attention, first of all because of the importance of the finds being made there in their own right, and secondly because it was happening in the public streets and squares of Mdina. Mm-hmm. So it was de facto receiving the attention of thousands of casual visitors. And the press picked up on that rightly so, and it has therefore become it was a topic which was discussed in the media quite extensively, at least for archaeology. Actually Mdina is a case in point. Mdina is a standing monument of multicultural identity. It's Abel Awex is lyrical about its history and importance all the way to our own days. But it has actually received very, very little archaeological attention. And the archaeological data per se prior to up to the mid 90s was very, very scanty and of an antiquarian nature. So we knew about a few inscriptions, a few reported findings, but it did not amount to an archaeological picture of Mdina. But this has changed with the progressive monitoring, more strict monitoring of works going on in Mdina. So throughout the 90s, we had a series of opportunities to investigate selected spots across Mdina. And then as of the year 2000, down to last year, in 2005, we have had a series of very big interventions across Mdina, the streets of Mdina, in connection with the paving exercise and the relaying of the utilities. All these works have been accompanied by archaeological monitors and occasionally large-scale excavations. So today we have a series of two types of data from Mdina. The first is in-depth sondages in various locations across the town. A sondage is, of course, a relatively small trench, but which sinks deep into the earth, therefore picking up data mainly of a sequential nature. So you get all the historical periods represented in your trench. And we also have plan data, so open area excavation, as we did in the square, and a bit in Villanion Street. And there we have actually exposed entire planimetries of buildings. So buildings not seen in sequence, but in extension, in plan. We have the full plans of structures. This put together is giving us a very, very interesting idea of Mdina's growth, origins and growth. We know now that we have a mid-Bronze Age occupation of the town at the very... That's the latest date we can attest. We suspect earlier dates, all the way to the Renaissance, going through, of course, all the successive historical periods, and not surprisingly, we did of course come across important evidence for the Byzantine, late antiquity, and Islamic periods, which were completely unknown. These we came across very rich deposits. And they have become for us the key guideline for the study of the period. So, for example, we have some very rich layers from the early 11th century from Mesquita Square, which are the classic layer to compare with, very rich in glazes, in Islamic amphor, in glass. A late Norman layer, for example, a similar late Norman layer was uncovered in the square in front of the cathedral, with the animal bone, the ceramics, the glassware, etc. These are, besides the actual construction history of the town, which is emerging from this data. So Mdina is really the flagship for medieval archaeology because it is charting all the fixed points, or it's charting some fixed points for research in other areas. Of course, Mdina is in itself a huge monument to medieval achievement and medieval culture, and the sequence of its occupation and redesign, and Mdina has gone through many very radical reoccupations, are still being worked out. But what we can say for now is that there seems to be a very complex series of defensive phases to the town. It's not a single defensive circuit which was repeated from classical antiquity. And there seems to be extensive evidence for late Byzantine and Islamic construction in Mdina. And it is on this basis which the Normans later and the Aragonese later still built the Mdina we know today. The Mdina we know today has very little resemblance to the classical Punic and Roman town.
Just for those listeners who might only have just joined us, this is The Artifact. I'm Patricia Camilleri and I'm talking to Nathaniel Kotayar, Acting Superintendent of Cultural Heritage, about medieval archaeology research in Malta. just to clarify, when we're talking Middle Ages, because you were mentioning the Arab period, mm-hmm. We are talking 8th century to... How far would you go with Middle Ages?
Well, historical chronology, the chronology we receive from history varies. Some people would place the start of the Middle Ages with the start of Christianity as an institutional religion from the 4th century. Mm-hmm. Others would place it closer to the... To the 5th century with the fall of the Western Roman Empire, but these are very subjective limits. Equally for the end of the Middle Ages, some people would place it at 1530 with the arrival of the knights, or with the building of Valletta 50 years later, or archaeologically, these are historical perceptions of the Middle Ages, where historians, of course, work with very precise date parameters. Archaeologically, and they are useful. Of course, the historical schemes are useful to work with, but they're not. We must remember the subjective partitioning of time. Sure. Time in itself flows endlessly. So, but what we do find in archaeology is that, and what is increasingly becoming the norm across the Mediterranean, is to fudge the difference between the Roman world and the early Middle Ages on one hand. So one may legitimately take a medieval archaeological team all the way down to the 3rd century, for example, or indeed before if necessary, and equally the distinction between modernity and the Middle Ages is becoming ever more fuzzy and difficult to establish, because it is much more rewarding to see how, rather than how the Middle Ages suddenly died and modernity started, which is not what actually happened by any means, is to see how later events are built on the earlier ones. And this is very true, of course, for all aspects of the Middle Ages. Much of what was medieval culture in Malta was very much alive and kicking all the way up till the late 16th century, maybe even until the 17th century. If we didn't have the benefit of the archives, some aspects of medieval archaeology would definitely be considered as still carrying on into the 17th century, equally for the earlier limit. So the point between Romanity and medieval culture is very, very much the result. The distinction is the result of a very long, slow process, and one must start looking at the Middle Ages, the changes which lead to the Middle Ages, at least from the 4th century minimum, if not earlier. But we're speaking roughly between, say, the end of the 4th century and the 16th century is the general
time frame
we're discussing.
The maritime dimension of Maltese archaeology has been sort of highlighted over the last decade. How is this reflect? How does this reflect on the Middle Ages as a period here in Malta?
Yes, this is the sea has been like Mdina, an area where it was known there were great riches, archaeological riches. There was a lot of episodic recovery of items, but again, there was up to about the 1970s and 80s, into the 1980s, there was very little systematic study of what the sea represents in terms of Maltese archaeology. This has changed, and this is a general indicator of the development of Maltese archaeological research and debate. And what we have seen in the course of the 90s and the early part of this decade is a surge of systematic research, surveying, and to a lesser extent excavation, and inventory work of what is being found at sea. And this has created, as you said yourself, a great shift in interest. So now there are many more people working, I repeat, in a systematic manner, on the analysis of what the sea represents to Maltese history and culture. And it could not be otherwise, but it has, of course, impacted on the Middle Ages. again, as with urban archaeology, as with the archaeology of Mdina, which has revealed a very dynamic situation, series of changes within on the hill, which we today call Mdina. The sea is also giving us an idea of great activity. And this is, again, somewhat surprising because it is not so clearly reflected in the archival work, archival evidence. So historians do not have the materia prima to actually reconstruct the dimension of maritime activity in the Middle Ages in Malta, partially because for some periods we simply do not have the paperwork. There's no Islamic archive for the Maltese islands. There's no Byzantine archive. And partly because the archives for the later Middle Ages, which do survive, are oriented on Mdina, not on Birgo. Or indeed on other communities which are looking outwards towards the sea, like Zuri, for example, or Meliha. And archaeology is now stepping in to fill in this gap to some extent. Of course, we can't replace the historical evidence, the contracts, but we are coming up with the material evidence.
And these things that you are discovering at sea, are these impacting on that rather traditional perception of the Maltese in the Middle Ages as sort of inward-looking and agrarian society?
Yes, by all means. What we're having is a merging of two sets of data, the data being recovered from land, from both urban and rural sites, and from the seas. And at sea, the most interesting data is not the shipwreck data, but the data being recovered from the harbours, from, for example, the Grand Harbour. And these are harbour deposits, items being jettisoned from ships and from wharfs into the seabed, and then being recovered archaeologically. And what they're showing, these now we speak about tens and tens of objects, is that we have some very intense use of harbours. And surprisingly, not only of the Grand Harbour, where Birgu was, where the Byzantines set up in Marsa was, but across practically every major harbour in Malta. So we have big scatters of Byzantine material from Marsa Shlok, Marsa Scala. We have a very similar situation in Salina, something on Comino, Santa Maria. In Marsa Mshet, next to Manuel Island, actually. So what we're seeing is that actually right up to some, I would say, about the 11th century, right into the Islamic period, the harbours, harbour activity is not only centred on the Grand Harbour or indeed only on Birgo, but has a satellite. The islet has a series of outposts, if you like, commercial outposts, on every single major harbour, including some of the less obvious ones. And this means that there's trading going on, not only by a centralized state elite, say at Birgo or being directed from Mdina, but that every community is carrying on its own trade. And this is matching up, of course, as I said, with what we're having on land, where we're seeing importations of maiolica and glazes
from the Maghreb.
Malta's trading throughout the Middle Ages heavily with North Africa, mainly Tunisia, from the Aegean, from the Adriatic and from the Mediterranean. Number one partner is Tunisia, but the other areas are very, very highly represented. With a trickle of goods coming in from even more outlying regions like Cyprus and Egypt and Spain.
So that in fact was going to sort of pulls into what is going to have to be, unfortunately, my last sort of question, really. Malta and the regional picture.
Yes. So to wrap up the last question and then enter the, what we're seeing is that Maltese medieval communities were very much Mediterranean communities. There were people who, by the looks of it, spent a lot of time abroad and this is based mainly on the ceramic evidence, not on the archival evidence, there are certain periods of Maltese medieval archaeology where the only ceramics found on the island are imported. They are not even bothering to do their own ceramics, which is sort of very, very wasteful use of apparent. But this shows the ready availability of foreign imported ceramics, and this is showing, illustrating a unit, a human cultural unit, an economic unit, which is very active throughout the region, which is taking economic advantage of openings right across the Mediterranean, from the big areas, the Adriatic, the Aegean, North Africa, to even much more difficult markets further afield, as Spain and Egypt at different ends of the Mediterranean. And they are very active, they are enterprising, and the interesting thing is that to really appreciate what is going on here, you must compare it to what's going on abroad. Just to give you one set of data, the amount of Oriental Aegean, for example, amphora appearing in Rome in the 7th and 8th century, in the 8th century, say. This is immediately after Gregory the Great, so that, to put it in perspective, so it's really Romanist medieval peak. It's more or less comparable to the number of 8th century amphora from our sites. So this is a network which is can only be appreciated when you see when the great markets are... such as Rome, compared with a little regional market such as Malta, is very striking, and the full significance of this has to be understood.
Thank you very, very much, Nathaniel. We've come to the end of the programme. Thanks for talking to us about the changing face, really, of medieval archaeological research in Malta. Until next time, this is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.